Hi, I'm Tori Maguire, and this is a Please Explain Extra. New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern is one of the most popular world leaders. She sat down with The Age and Sydney Morning Herald's chief political correspondent David Crowe to talk gender inequality, refugee policy, politics, and motherhood.
It's now been 4 months since Christchurch. I was in Osaka when Scott Morrison talked to leaders there about getting social media companies to take much faster action to remove violent content and in fact find ways to change their algorithms, as you said in your Christchurch call, to really fix the problem at the outset. Are you satisfied with what you're hearing from social media companies on that front?
I think it would be too premature for me at this point to make a judgment about whether or not we can be satisfied over the work that's happened in the period since the call was made. We very deliberately at that time set up another point where we would check in. And so September is that point. That'll be both an opportunity for additional countries who wish to support the call to come on board, but also for us to see what progress is being made. But it's not a matter of us sitting dormant in the in-between time. Officials are continuing to engage with social media companies. We have expectations around a couple of areas. Of course, greater transparency around algorithm use, greater research into ways that we can try and prevent the high speed and mass proliferation online of this content when it does emerge. Crisis protocol, so if we do have a situation like this in the future, how can we respond more quickly? And the role of the GIFCT, the institution that kind of already exists that social media companies are a part of, but that could be, I think, probably utilised more successfully as a bit of a clearinghouse for some of this work.
So I presume that if it's too early now to say whether you're satisfied with their progress, I'm assuming from that they haven't come to you yet with proof that they can do something.
Well, of course, at the time that we signed the call, we already saw announcements out of Facebook of what they were going to do to address some of those concerns around live streaming. And so there's been some of those, that the little incremental signs of work underway. Our officials are working more closely and directly with the social media companies on some of those things like the GIFCT and the crisis protocol. The chance for leaders to check in again will be September, but it's fair to say we have expectations. Two tracks here. I do think we have to make sure that our domestic legislation is fit for purpose as well. We identified a few areas where perhaps our legislation wasn't as fit for purpose now that we're in an online environment in terms of objectionable content. We had to use legislation that was really designed for broadcast media. And so, making sure that we do a bit of work in that space. But at the same time, having expectations, though, around companies, around their social license, to make sure that they are doing what they can and should to prevent what happened on the 15th of March ever happening again.
And in the Christchurch call, you talked about putting it on the agenda at the United Nations later this year.
Yes.
I know Scott Morrison is going to that meeting as well, as will so many world leaders. Yeah. Is there a plan at this point about how you take it further forward at the UN?
Very much for us is a chance to continue the momentum. Again, some work, obviously, before the Christchurch call was already underway. So we've been working closely with Jordan, for instance, who have had a dialogue for some time with the social media companies and continuing that. Really for us, this is just another natural point to reconvene and continue to show that there is no loss of urgency, there is no loss of momentum here, and the expectation still exists. In fact, it's growing. If the G20 demonstrates anything, it demonstrates that.
There's a lot of concern in the community about violence online, about the way in which social media is changing young people, changing the community.
Yeah.
Do you think that there's any place for consumer action on the issues that you've put forward about taking down violent content? Is there something consumers can do, because you've talked about people power in the past?
Yeah.
Is this an area where there's a space for people power?
In most environments there would be, just for merely the fact that consumers can exercise their choice. I think one of the issues that we have actually is dominant players in the market where there aren't a lot of choices. That doesn't stop consumers from having a voice. It just means that it's not always necessarily easily executed by them choosing to leave that product. And so instead, we absolutely are reliant on both civil society and users to raise directly their expectations. I think that has had some effect. The fact that Facebook have talked more openly about the way that they're going to uphold their community standards. But this has been one of the points that we've been making. Actually, those community standards set a higher bar than probably any domestic legislation ever will. And so if the companies would do well just to actually do what they say they will do online and maintain a level of protection there for users.
Also on Christchurch, there have been a couple of other questions that have come up. One of great concern in Australia is what happens to the accused terrorist.
Mm.
There has been a question about whether he could serve a sentence in Australia, whether that might be Australia's responsibility in a sense. Do you have a view on whether that should be served in New Zealand or in Australia?
Look, our focus has been entirely on making sure that he faces the justice system for now in New Zealand. And that's where our focus has been, to be honest, not having given thought to really beyond that process. It is important for us, though, that, of course, he faces the justice system in New Zealand.
In this city, there is a very large mural of you hugging a Muslim woman in Christchurch a week after the attack. There was a photograph of it on display last night, so I presume you've seen the image.
I have seen it. I manage my own social media and I've noticed that.
What do you think about it?
When someone goes for a jog or something, they'll tag me into it. I think the artist is you know, exceptional. Just the idea of being able to do something at such a large scale and that level of detail, I thought was really impressive. I don't think you would ever get used to seeing yourself enlarged in that way, though. I'm humbled by it, though, because you know, obviously what happened in Christchurch for me will always be about the Muslim community that it happened to. It didn't happen to me, you know, and so I feel a slight hesitance, therefore, to seeing those images for that. But I can also understand that it symbolises something different for everyone.
What struck me about the image is that it's not about an individual in a sense. It's about community.
That's true. That is true.
However, when I searched for the image, it was taken by a Getty photographer.
Mm, mm.
I don't know the name of the woman you're hugging.
Mm.
And I don't know whether you would have had time to know the name of the woman you were hugging because you were meeting a community.
Yes.
Have you had time to go back to that community and check in with them again? Because I'd be fascinated in that woman's story.
Yes. I know exactly where we were standing when it happened and exactly the moment that it happened. That wasn't the first image of an embrace with a member of the community. That particular photo was taken in Wellington, but there were some photo images taken the day prior, on the Saturday, where it was members of the Christchurch Muslim community. And those members I have seen multiple times since, and we've met multiple times since, and I know their stories and their backgrounds well, better than the one that was captured in Wellington. But I do hope to see her again. But that I think that what that captured really was that the Muslim community, of course, throughout New Zealand was just obviously felt so acutely that grief on behalf of those who were directly affected as well.
And how did you feel when you were doing that hug, giving that woman a hug in that way?
I mean, on every occasion, it was always just about a human response. When you see someone that's grieving and they're right in front of you and you feel a huge sense of grief as well and a huge desire to comfort the people around you. Obviously, I have lots of ways that I can do that aren't just around providing, a physical show of that comfort. My job was to comfort people through action and policy changes and that as well. But it doesn't stop you being human. So I think it was just a human reaction. I think lots of other people would have done exactly the same thing.
In New South Wales, the town where the accused terrorist came from is Grafton. It's a town I spent some time in when I was growing up. Lovely country town. I'm not sure whether you're aware, but the mayor of Grafton has extended an invitation to you. You know, the community there would welcome that as a sign of togetherness and inclusion. Is that something that you're aware of?
And
do you have any interest?
I wasn't aware of that. know, I think that there's been nothing greater that has demonstrated the sense of togetherness and humanity than the response from the Muslim community who were directly affected themselves. And you will have seen some of the speeches at the memorial, particularly those that were, even from those who had lost family members, moving immediately to the sense of forgiveness and compassion, which to me is incredible to see a response like that in the wake of something so of that scale. And so I think the community themselves have modelled that, yeah. And I hope the members of that community in Australia have seen that.
There's a big debate in Australia about what Scott Morrison calls the step up in the Pacific. Now, I'm interested in whether you have any thoughts on the level of engagement with the Pacific at the moment. Is it an area where there's been any neglect by Australia and New Zealand? There's obviously a debate about that in Australia. And also, what your thoughts are on Pacific Island nations turning sometimes towards China, either to receive aid funding, sometimes to take on debt, which comes with obligations. Yeah. Is that a concern in New Zealand for your government when you're looking at relations with the Pacific?
Yeah, a couple of perspectives from us. Of course, I can't speak to anyone else's foreign policy approach, but there are some similarities to the sentiment from our government and Scott Morrison's government in terms of our focus in the Pacific. Now, I can speak to our motivation for why that is. We see ourselves very strongly as having a Pacific identity. You know, we're part of the Pacific. We have obviously a significant portion of our population, obviously, of that origin as well. But that's only part of the equation. For us, it was about looking out and saying, well, actually, as members of the Pacific, we need to ensure that our relationship is reflects that, and that we move from what has traditionally been perhaps perceived as a donor-donee relationship instead to one that actually recognises these are democratic nations, developing nations, and one where we need to make sure that our relationships reflect that. So that's, from our perspective, the focus. And there's a lot of conversation that's been, is that changing simply because of the presence of other countries? And, you know, I think that, you know, that's a shame that people would think that we would only be motivated by that. That's certainly not the perspective that we hold. Again, though, it's not for me to judge then in terms of the aid and grant decisions other countries are making. It's our job, of course, to make sure that we're supporting the priorities that other Pacific Island nations may have. We have, for instance, a $300 million fund that we've established to support the climate change aspirations of our Pacific neighbours, adaptation, mitigation, particularly around renewables. So, you know, where there's gaps, we're looking to try and support. But ultimately, those decisions about where else those nations may look, we need to accept that these, of course, are democratic countries.
Mm-hmm. Another foreign policy question in the news this week is the deterioration in relations with Iran. Now, I ask about this because I know that in the past, the New Zealand Navy has served in the Middle East on some operations, stopping piracy, for instance, or dealing with narcotics trade. I've seen reports of that work in the past. One question around at the moment is whether shipping needs to be secured in those waters. Do you think that there's any role for New Zealand on that front? Because it does look like the situation is getting more serious and there may need to be a need to secure the shipping.
And specifically in that region of the Middle East?
Yeah.
Look, we haven't had direct asks there. You'll see that from some of our Defence Force strategies and conversations, you know, we do have an increasingly regionalised focus. We do see that there are needs in our own region that we think that we do need to make sure that we prioritise. That's not to neglect the other parts of the world that may at any given time demand the international community's attention. But we do see that as being an area where that we need to lend our attention to. You know, particularly as we see the effects of climate change, our Defence Force, of course, has always played a specific role in providing humanitarian aid and support. We see that probably only likely to increase as we see those severe weather events. And so we are having a greater regional focus. Mm-hmm. But again, it's not to diminish there maybe being need in the future, but for now that's where we're turning our minds.
Okay. Now, on the subjects that you looked at last night in your speech, politics today, the negativity that we see so often, one theme we've seen this week, it's impossible not to see it, is that message to people of ethnic background, go back to where you came from. Now, we've seen that in the US this week, but it's also a message that we've heard in Australia sometimes, probably in New Zealand too. When you hear that spoken by politicians or political leaders, what's your message in response to that kind of call?
I would like to think that in New Zealand, broadly speaking, across the House, that there is a level of pride that we have a parliament that increasingly looks like New Zealand and has the diversity of New Zealand. A House of Representatives should. After all, it's set to represent all New Zealanders, age, gender, ethnicity. And I'm proud of the fact that increasingly our parliament does that. That's a source that should be a source of celebration. Therefore, it will be obvious to most people what my thoughts are of comments that perhaps undermine that position.
And to be specific, obviously, there was that comment by Donald Trump in the States. But look, it's a comment that Fraser Anning has made in an Australian senator has made in Australia. These are things that are aired. I should ask you specifically what your response is to that Donald Trump message.
Look, and by and large, I don't get into the domestic politics of other countries, and, you know, as you'd expect. But on that particular case, I think it was so obvious to people what my view would be. So I just made it clear I disagreed. Because that will be obvious to people. I disagree.
Can you say why you disagree?
Oh, I'm someone who celebrates. In fact, I'm proud to come from a country that I think, by and large, celebrates diversity. And, you know, when you're in a leadership position, you need to model the treatment you expect of others.
Do you think that racism is on the rise generally or in politics?
In politics? Oh, well, generally. Look, I do think there's an increasing tendency for... there's an increase in fear globally. I think fear probably rooted in a sense of insecurity, particularly financial insecurity. Now, whether or not that's a sense that people don't have that security of perception of security of job opportunities, digital transformation, the future of work, you know, population and migrant flows, whatever the cause, I think there is a sense of insecurity. And in that environment, politicians have very clear choices. They can either choose to profit from that by stoking a sense of fear and binding particular either institutions or groups to blame. Or we can reject that and say, you know, if we haven't dealt with inequality issues, or if we've got a growing sense that people are living on inadequate incomes or don't have job security or, you know, failing on home ownership, then actually we need to own that as politicians and we need to come up with the solutions rather than placing blame or stoking fear. So I think that's the stark choice that we have in politics at the moment. And for me, it feels very clear-cut. And there's only one place we end up, I think, when you choose the option of blame. And I don't think it's good for democracy or for society.
What is the solution then to racism on the rise in a community, or that insecurity being on the rise in a community? What are the steps to tackle it?
I mean, firstly, look, we all as political leaders just need to model the behaviour that we... You know, I actually distill it down to a really simple concept. How do we want our kids to treat other people? You know, what are the principles and values that we try to treat to raise our families with? It's as simple as that. You know, why wouldn't we model that as politicians as well? Because this is some concept I've always found really interesting, that with politicians we have an expectation almost that they will be aggressive and relatively brash and, you know, have particular character traits. So we raise our kids to be kind and to be generous and to be compassionate. But actually, then if you transition into these roles, we don't have an expectation. And in fact, if you hold those character traits, maybe you're weak. Why would we have that disconnect? So I hold a very simple view. It's just about modelling the kind of expectations that we might have of children. You wouldn't think that if you saw Parliament, though.
I can't
for a moment pretend that we are, you know, that our politics is still not an aggressive place. It is. It very much is, yeah.
Well, can you take some of that aggression out of politics? Is it actually possible? Now, and let's be, you know, you've broken down barriers as a woman in politics.
Mm.
You have a different approach. It comes through in your speeches.
Mm.
That your budget speech this year was just so different to a standard budget speech that I get every year.
Thank you for noticing.
In federal parliament in Australia.
I was very deliberate about that.
Completely different.
Yeah, I said to the team, this year I don't want to just do the 20 different things that were in the budget. I don't want to just do the economic profile and snapshot in time. That's what every budget speech does. If the wellbeing budget is different, why shouldn't my budget speech be different? So I appreciate you noticing.
Well, do you think that that's changing politics, though? Is it, because that would be a very difficult thing to change, to take the aggression out of politics.
Yeah, it is. It is. It absolutely is. Does that mean we don't try? I don't think I've sat down and thought, right, my agenda is to change the nature of politics. I think instead I've just thought, I'm going to do this in a way that I feel comfortable. And whether or not that then creates some kind of legacy where others can see that they can go into politics and be themselves and choose not to be completely focused on collecting scalps and careers, then that's a good byproduct. But there's only so much you can change, and my focus has been probably more on outcomes for New Zealand rather than whether or not I can fundamentally change the political landscape.
Well, one thing that struck me last night during your speech was, 2,000 people in Melbourne Town Hall.
It's quite
enthusiastic,
a daunting thing to walk into.
Yeah, very enthusiastic response to your speech.
Mm.
And what struck me was the weight of expectations, because at one point one of the people there, Auntie Joy, said, you know, you've restored her faith in humanity.
Yes.
You were described several times as an inspiration.
Yeah.
I wondered whether you feel the weight of expectations.
Yes.
Does that get to you at any point?
I do feel that, yeah. Yep.
Does it make it harder to do the job you do?
I don't know it's possible to make the job any harder. I do feel that, but still, though, even amongst that, you just have to just take every day as it comes. And I'd like, you know, if my, in part, you know, view of or approach to politics as being human about it, I've also need to accept it means I'm going to make mistakes. And even from the very beginning, when I first took on the job, I said that I'm going to make mistakes. But we should be human in politics, and we should be willing to acknowledge when we haven't been able to do things we wanted to do. No one expects us to be superhuman. They just want us to be honest.
What do you think is next for equality for women? You are, as I mentioned, you know,
you'll have to tell me which bit we've ticked off in order for us to move on, because I'm not seeing anything particularly obvious at present.
And I'll admit my question may not be ideally framed, but
no.
But what's your perception? I mean, because you have broken down barriers already as a female leader in politics. What's your assessment of progress so far on equality for women, and what's your assessment of what the next priorities should be?
Financial security. So much of it comes out. I don't think I would actually oversimplify it just to frame that as dealing with the pay gap, which is obviously an obvious frontier. But for me, just the fact that our women in New Zealand, at least, are overrepresented in low-paid work. They are so often, often in many cases, a large number, obviously, sole parents and often in precarious work, and that creates many limitations for them and their families, and it also creates vulnerability. You know, so when I think about, you know, the family violence, there's a linkage there to financial insecurity. So yes, look, I think people have an expectation that I talk about women in leadership and representation on boards, and all of that's important. But for me, it's important because then we have women in positions to think about those other issues. We can have 50% women on boards. We can have 50% women in our leading our public sector, which we do. You can have a woman in the top job, but until we see women lifted out of some of those really vulnerable situations, that for me is when we will have succeeded.
And does that require hard law, basically, to lift those pay rates to actually help women with financial insecurity?
It is. I think it's, you know, there are a broad range of areas that we need to be focused. First of all, of course, yes, things like lifting minimum wage help. There's, of course, going through pay equity exercises helps because, of course, we do have women overrepresented in those areas that have tended to be low-paid work. Landmark decision in New Zealand around home care workers demonstrates the effect that things of that magnitude, settlements of that magnitude can have. But then there's the harder, probably area where we just haven't quantified in the same way, just making sure that our women and our girls overcome the confidence gap, see that actually they can aspire to continue in their education, to take up opportunities and to overcome the barriers that might get in the way of them being able to do that. That's the longer term goal.
As a female Prime Minister, one of the remarks made about your career so far is, of course, giving birth to a baby while in office.
Yes.
Still something that it's unusual and remarked
Bhutto.
Upon. Are you?
She was the only other one, Benazir Bhutto. And the remarkable thing to me is that Neve was born on her birthday.
Was she?
She was.
Are you tired now yet of people remarking upon that as being unusual?
No.
What's your assessment of how it's been?
Yeah. Oh no, I don't tire of it. I understand when it's only happened twice, it's noteworthy, but it'll be great when it's not. So no, I absolutely understand people's interest. The perhaps the beauty for me is I've never been Prime Minister without ever being pregnant or having a small child to care for. So this is all that I know. One of the things that I always highlight, though, is that I am not some kind of Wonder Woman. I don't successfully juggle care in this role on my own. Clark is the primary caregiver, and we have amazing mothers, and that's how we do it. There is no point to going around pretending that I have some kind of magical powers that let me charge through unaided. Why should we put that kind of pressure on women or expect them to do that?
Mm. And can I ask, how is Neve at the moment?
Very busy.
Busy with what?
Life, just everything. Opening every cupboard in the house, pulling out every piece of clothing and book she can. She's doing the normal things that occupy a one-year-old's time.
That's great. I have one final question on a completely different subject.
Sure.
Which is something that's come up before between Australia and New Zealand. It's the treatment of refugees. It's the idea talked about of whether New Zealand might accept any refugees from Manus Island and Nauru. Mm. Is that something that is still there as a possibility? And what are your thoughts on if, when, and under what conditions it might ever happen?
So, look, that's been an offer that's been on the table actually since the last government in New Zealand. The offer was made originally under Prime Minister John Key. It's remained on the table. We've consistently made it. The Australian government knows that it's there. We've always said that it's a matter ultimately for them. However, of course, we've always said as well it would be an offer for refugees, so that's the area, of course, where you'd always make sure that that's where New Zealand's input would be. But ultimately, status remains the same.
Is it still 150 places? Is there a number?
The offer hasn't changed, and the offer was 150.
And has it come up in any discussions between yourself and Scott Morrison? Did it come up today, for instance?
Our offer has been consistent. Nothing about it has changed.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this week's Podcast Extra. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Subscriptions power our newsrooms. To support independent journalism, search subscribe Sydney Morning Herald or The Age. This episode was produced and edited by Taylor Denny, Margaret Gordon and Cormac Lally. Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. For more insights and in-depth analysis, check out our regular episode, which will drop this Thursday.